Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Revolution 250 podcast. I am Bob Allison. I chair the Rev 250 Advisory Group. We are a consortium of 70 organizations in Massachusetts looking at ways to commemorate the beginnings of American independence. And our guest today is Matthew Skick. And Matthew Skick, welcome to the podcast, Matthew.
And thank you for having me, Bob.
And Matthew Skick is the curator of exhibitions at the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia, a tremendous institution. You've been there since the beginning.
Yes, I joined the staff in June of 2016. And you know, that previous summer in 2015, I had interned for the museum. So I've got a chance to help open the museum to the public in 2017.
It's really an exciting opportunity to open something new that's going to tell these old stories, but tell them in a new way.
Definitely. And it's a lifelong passion of mine to study the American Revolution and to be able to open a national scale institution dedicated to telling that story. It's a once in a lifetime opportunity. Really? And I'm so happy to be a part of it.
Really? And you were just telling me you grew up near Washington's Crossing in New Jersey.
That's right. Yeah, about 10 minutes away from where Washington crossed the Delaware in central New Jersey. And my first job as a teenager was as a historical interpreter at Washington Crossing State Park.
Good thing you stuck with it then through college and through, you got an MA at the University of Delaware in the winter tour, you know, doing material culture kinds of things to prepare you for a career in museums.
Exactly right. Yep. I remember writing in seventh grade that I wanted to be a museum curator. And here I am now getting to do that. And I studied history down in Washington, D.C. at American University, and then went to the University of Delaware to continue that path and then landed here at the museum.
Great. And we're actually going to talk about one of the exhibits you've had up. You still have the virtual exhibit about one of these extraordinary figures in American history, James Fortin of Philadelphia.
Right. So last year, in February of 2023, the Museum of the American Revolution opened up Black Founders, the Fortin Family of Philadelphia, which was the first major exhibit to tell the story of the Fortin family and dedicate a whole exhibit dedicated to telling that story. And the focal point of the story is James Fortin, who as a young man, he grew up here in Philadelphia, part of the growing free Black community in Philadelphia. And as a teenager, he signed up to serve aboard a privateer ship fighting on behalf of the United States during the Revolutionary War. And then he went on to become a successful businessman here in Philadelphia, accumulated great wealth as a sailmaker, became the wealthiest African-American person in the city, and perhaps even the entire United States in the early 19th century, and had eight children who survived to adulthood. And so we talked about not only James Fortin, but the generation of his children and also his grandchildren. So three generations of one family from 1776 to 1876. So it's a great way to look at use one family as a window through which to look at the first 100 years of the United States as an independent nation.
It really is. And a lot of exciting things in the exhibit, but I think one of the favorites is the Bible. That is, you were able to find, or one of his descendants put on permanent, like a gift to the museum of the Fortin family Bible.
That's right. Yeah, it was a truly remarkable and very generous. And as we were doing a lot of the preparatory research for the exhibit, we were working alongside James Fortin's biographer, Julie Winch,
who from recently UMass retired. Boston.
Exactly, UMass Boston. And she, after her book was published, A Gentleman of Color, The Life of James Fortin, that was about just over 20 years ago now, she was contacted by a direct descendant of James Fortin. In fact, his great, 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 great grandson, who lives out in Illinois, but is originally from Philadelphia. And he said, I have the Fortin family Bible, but and Julie kept in touch with Atwood Fortin Jacobs. He goes by Kip, though. And then we rekindled that connection with him in anticipation of this exhibit. And initially, Kip and his daughter Taylor put the Bible on loan to the museum, but then they decided in March of 2023 to donate it to the museum. And so it's now part of our collection. And it's currently on display in our core exhibit. But what's great about this particular Bible is that it, in the middle of it, it has, like many other Bibles, family records pages. So listing out births, deaths, and marriages for seven generations of the family. And in some cases, this is the only place where that genealogical information is written down. And so it's a real treasure for Philadelphia, especially African-American history in this city and connected to such a prominent Black family of the early 19th century. It's truly remarkable.
It really is. We're talking with Matthew Skick, the curator of exhibitions at the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia, and we're talking about their exhibit, Black Founders, the Fortin Family of Philadelphia. And James Fortin, as I said, he's born in Philadelphia, and he's about 9 years old in 1776, and he hears the Declaration of Independence read outside Independence Hall in July of 1776, and this makes a great impression on him.
It sure does, and this is a story that he would continue to tell throughout his life, to say that he was there for that day on July 8, 1776, during the first public reading of the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. Like you said, Bob, he's just 9 years old at the time. And this Declaration of Independence is something that he would quote and reference in his later writings when he is on the rise as an abolitionist leader, equal rights leader, a civil rights leader in Philadelphia. And when he sort of enters a more national stage through his writings in the early 19th century, he's frequently quoting the Declaration of Independence and referring to it and saying that, you know, this is what the United States needs to live up to adhere to. These are the founding ideals. And that's one of the reasons why we called the exhibit Black Founders. James Fortin is trying to encourage the United States to increase and enhance and strengthen its commitment to its founding ideals, ideals that James Fortin fought for as a teenager.
Right. Right. Yeah. So then when he's 14, he enlists aboard a privateer, the Royal Louis, or Royal Louis.
Yes, exactly. Named for King Louis the 16th, the new ally of the United States. And this privateer vessel was a purpose-built vessel for privateering built here in Philadelphia. Mm. Its captain was Stephen Decatur, the father of the more famous Stephen Decatur. Stephen Decatur commanded that vessel, and in the summer of 1781, when he took command, James Fortin was one of the youngest members of the crew, but one of about 20 or so Black sailors aboard the ship. And the first voyage that the Royal Louis goes on in the late summer of 1781 is pretty successful. They tow in some British prizes back to Philadelphia. Auction off those prizes, and so the crew earns money from those captures, and then the Royal Louis goes on its second voyage, but it falls quickly into British hands. It's captured by a superior vessel, the Amphion, and based on the logbook of the Amphion, the HMS Amphion, that capture was made just off the coast of Virginia in October of 1781.
And this is right around the time of Yorktown.
Exactly right. Yeah. So there's a lot of things going on in that area. And there's a lot of French and British naval activity going on. And the Royal Louis sort of falls into that. They're captured. The crew and the ship are brought up to New York, of course, which is occupied by the British, their headquarters in North America. Mm-hmm. And James Fortin and his crewmates are put aboard the prison ship, the Jersey, in New York Harbor.
Notorious prison ship Jersey.
Exactly. And James Fortin spends 7 months aboard that prison ship. He's released in 1782.
Now, he had an opportunity, according to tradition, of not having to stay aboard the prison ship. Is that right?
That's right. And this is a story that was shared by just after James Fortin's death, just before the mid 19th century, by Robert Purvis. So that's James Fortin's son-in-law, who worked closely with his father-in-law as an abolitionist. And Robert Purvis shared the story that James Fortin would tell him that before Fortin was put aboard the prison ship, the captain of the Amphion, John Baisley, offered Fortin the opportunity to come to England and live with the Baisley family, because John Baisley's son sort of struck up a relationship with James Fortin aboard, because Baisley's son was a cabin boy aboard the ship, an officer's servant, maybe serving his father. Mm-hmm. And Fortin was sort of distracting the young captain's son. And so Fortin actually turned down that opportunity to go to England. And according to Robert Purvis, Fortin said that he would not turn his back on the country he was fighting for. And so then he goes aboard the prison ship, and Fortin has another opportunity to get away from the situation he's in. And that's when an American officer is being exchanged, and that officer has a sea chest with him, and Fortin can fit in that sea chest. But instead he gives his place up to a young man named Daniel Bruton, who is also a teenager from Philadelphia, but he was a bit sickly aboard the prison ship. So Fortin gives his place up to Daniel Bruton, a young white sailor, and Bruton makes it successfully out of the Jersey and makes it back to Philadelphia. And Bruton and Fortin later reconnect later in life in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And Bruton vouches for what James Fortin did for him when they were just teenagers. Imagine those decisions these young men were making.
Really? Really? I mean, not to go to England, where your life certainly would be different, better than being on a prison ship, and then letting someone else go in your place in this sea chest to escape.
Right.
So Fortin doesn't know
Fortin doesn't know what those outcomes are going to be. What's his future going to truly hold?
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah, we're talking with Matthew Skick, the curator of exhibitions at the Museum of the American Revolution, and we're talking about their exhibit, which is still online. You can see the exhibit online, the Black Founders, the Fortin Family of Philadelphia. So James Fortin, at the age of, what is he now, about 16, 17, has been a prisoner of war, and then the war ends, and so he makes his way, how does he make his way back to Philadelphia from New York?
Well, when he's released from the Jersey, he actually walks all the way back from New York to Philadelphia, walks across New Jersey. There's a story that he received some assistance in Trenton, New Jersey, about 100 miles that he journeys back. And he comes back home to his mother and his sister. Yeah. His father had died in about 1773, but he comes back home to his mother and sister, who I bet were just shocked to see him. That he was still alive.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah.
He makes it back and continues to live in Philadelphia. He briefly travels with some family members to England on a brief voyage, but comes back to Philadelphia after that. And then he apprentices himself to his father's old boss, actually. And that's a white sailmaker named Robert Bridges, a prominent sailmaker in Philadelphia. And, James Fortin works his way up the ladder of that sailmaking company and becomes the foreman of Bridges' shop, which included a workforce of about 30 men. It was an integrated workforce. But now, as sort of his right-hand man, Robert Bridges appoints a young African-American man, James Fortin, to be the foreman. And this is really amazing story. And when Robert Bridges is thinking about what's next for his own life, and he's thinking about retirement, he wants his own sons to do better than working with their hands. He wants them to be, merchants or doctors or lawyers. oftentimes those, you know, usually those opportunities are denied for African Americans mm-hmm. at the time. But James Fortin is given the opportunity to take over the business, and he takes that opportunity from Bridges and leads mm-hmm. that sail making business from 1798 until 1842 when he dies. So almost 45 years.
Wow. Wow. That is a long career. And in that time, he becomes very successful with the sail making business. You had some sail making tools in your exhibit, which was kind of neat to see the tools exactly. of the trade.
Yeah, we tried to get give visitors a sense of the sail making trade and mm-hmm. what Fortin would have been doing on a daily basis alongside his workers. There are just a few paper remnants of his business. There are receipts of James Fortin's work that he's doing that we were able to put on view, original mm-hmm. receipts. But we also recreated a portion of what James Fortin's sail loft might have looked like. And mm-hmm. this was a hands-on activity space with facilitated by our talented educators here at the museum. And so you could try your hand at some stitching. You could feel mm-hmm. sailcloth, sit at a sailmaker's mm-hmm. bench. And adjacent to that was a display case, and you can see this in the online exhibit, of original sailmaking tools. Not James Fortin's tools, mm-hmm. but tools of the period. And these were actually recovered from a shipwreck called the HMS DeBrock, which sank in 1798, just happens to be the same year that James Fortin took over that sailmaking business. And so they're of the period. So it was neat to be able to have the documents, the replica tools, and then the original mm-hmm. tools all working together and to interpret that story.
Interesting. We're talking with Matthew Skick, the curator of exhibitions at the Museum of the American Revolution, and talking about their exhibit on Black Founders, the Fortin Family of Philadelphia. And sailmaking was really essential to this maritime economy. So you can see what an important thing this is that James Fortin's engaged in then for almost half a century. And again, his father had been a sailmaker before him, and he inherits this business, or he takes over the business from Robert Bridges, which is it's a great story of someone going into this business and running it successfully for such a long period of time during this period of great transition. And again, as he said, he becomes very successful. And then he is also very much involved in some of the emerging political movements. I didn't realize until I looked through the exhibit that he was one of the real backers of William Lloyd Garrison's newspaper, The Liberator, in the 1830s.
Exactly. It's a little known fact about Fortin and the history of the Liberator. Despite being separated by a generation in terms of years and their age, James Fortin and William Lloyd Garrison struck up a friendship, and which led to a lot of correspondence between the two. And when you are looking for, and as I was doing, trying to find where are all of James Fortin's papers and his writings and that sort of thing, you realize that the largest grouping of James Fortin's writings, his letters that he's writing, is in the William Lloyd Garrison papers at the Boston Public Library.
Interesting.
And so looking through that correspondence between Garrison and Fortin, it's pretty revealing about what James Fortin was doing to help kickstart the Liberator, which was, you know, William Lloyd Garrison's idea to create mm-hmm. a national scale abolitionist newspaper that wouldn't hold back. That was going to be targeting right. People, would be extremely critical of the expansion of slavery in the United States. And Fortin, there's a wonderful letter where Fortin is kind of wishing William Lloyd Garrison well and hoping that this newspaper can be a voice to the abolitionist movement. But Fortin is also trying to secure the first subscriptions for that newspaper here in Philadelphia, literally knocking on doors mm-hmm. In the Black community, in the abolitionist community here in the city, and mm-hmm. is one of the first financial backers of the Liberator to help kickstart it for Garrison. It becomes extremely successful. And mm-hmm. from the perspective of many slave owners and supporters of slavery in the United States, it's in their eyes, it's sort of a demon, because it's in their eyes, it's sort of inciting rebellion, and that sort of thing. Even so, when the Nat Turner Revolt happens, Fortin and Garrison correspond about that, and Garrison is seen as this instigator of revolts like this, and Fortin in some cases is seen as an instigator too. But there's a really amazing letter that James Fortin writes to Garrison that fall, after the revolt, news of the revolt is spreading, and he says, every day there's a new effort for liberty, either at home or abroad. And what he says to Garrison is, onward, onward is indeed the watchword. An incredible letter. He's very forward thinking, in his efforts.
Yes, he is. Yeah. And he also had a relationship with Paul Cuffee, who was a mariner from Nantucket, New Bedford. And he's a whaler. And I wonder if you want to talk about that relationship, Matthew.
Yes. Yeah. And another active correspondence that Fortin has is with Cuffee. And because of Cuffee's work and owning a ship, a merchant ship, it's coming into Philadelphia, and the correspondence that Cuffee and Fortin have really clues us into, in this case, Fortin is the younger of the person in this relationship now, and he's learning a lot from Paul Cuffee and his experience in New England, his experience as a merchant, as a successful business owner, essentially. What Cuffee is also discussing with Fortin is the idea that would become known as colonization. And that is people of African descent in the United States who maybe be enslaved or free, but actually moving them to colonies in Africa or the Caribbean to separate them from the white population of the United States. And initially, Cuffee and Fortin are supportive of this effort due to the racial prejudice and the expanding slavery in the United States. Cuffee is very influential in Fortin's thinking about that. But Fortin has a change of mind that happens in the 18-teens, in which the American Colonization Society is on the rise. Fortin is influenced by the black population of Philadelphia, who's very much against this idea of colonization. Why should we be forced to leave the country we fought to create? And Fortin, started writing that, and he became an opponent of colonization. This is well after Cuffee had passed away. But what's also interesting is that Fortin's business is supporting Cuffee as well. There's a receipt in Paul Cuffee's papers at the New Bedford Free Public Library in Massachusetts that is a receipt documenting that James Fortin's sailmaking shop was repairing sails for Paul Cuffee's ship, the Traveler. So we had that on display in the exhibit as well, that original receipt. So it's an interesting
That is an interesting relationship. You really found some interesting things for this exhibit. You had a model made of the Royal Lewis, and you had another ship model too on display. I mean, it was really good visually, the things you had, as well as some documents you had borrowed from the United Kingdom.
Exactly. That was among my favorite things in the exhibit was that ship model, which was a scale model of the Royal Lewis. We were able to work with a ship model builder who's extremely talented named Rex Stewart. He's based in Albany, New York. And that ship model is now on display in our core exhibit at the museum. So it lives on in that way. But the ship model itself helped to bring to life, in a way, the documents that we had on display adjacent to that. And that was the original letter of marque for the Royal Lewis that was issued by the Continental Congress in July of 1781 to Captain Stephen Decatur. And that came to the exhibit all the way from the National Archives of the United Kingdom. So why was it there?
Because it was, right? it was Yeah, that's right. It was captured.
Right, exactly. It was in the Board of Admiralty papers in the at the National Archives of the United Kingdom over in Kew. And this is the first time that that letter of marque is back in the United States since 1781. So just think about that. Wow. Isn't that cool?
That's great. That is great. And then you also commissioned Don Troiani to do a painting, because one of the other seminal events in Horton's life was a boy was seeing the Rhode Island Regiment marching through Philadelphia.
Exactly. Yep. And so this is on September 2nd, 1781. This is the brief period in which James Fortin is just about to leave for the second voyage of the Royal Lewis. So it's that in-between period of the first voyage and the second voyage. And it just happens to be his 15th birthday, September 2nd, 1781. Mm. And George Washington's army marching down from New Jersey and New York down through Philadelphia passes through the city on that day. And James Fortin is there. And he is among the thousands of people that turn out to watch the army march through. And little do these people know that they're going to go and fight the siege of Yorktown that later that fall.
Right.
And so what stands out in James Fortin's mind is seeing men of African descent, Native American men in the ranks of the Continental Army, some of which are in integrated regiments from New England and the Mid-Atlantic. But also he points out in some of his writings later on that he remembered seeing one of the New England regiments that had full companies of soldiers of color. And the this is a reference to the Rhode Island Regiment, which was a consolidation of the 1st and 2nd Rhode Island Regiments. And this new Rhode Island Regiment had two full companies of enlisted men of African and Native American descent, led by white officers. And in one letter to William Lloyd Garrison later in life, James Fortin conveys this memory. And he says, I well remember when Washington's army marched through Philadelphia and he saw this regiment that had these companies of Black men and Native American men marching along. And he remembered that these were as brave men as ever fought. So that gave title to a painting that we commissioned by Don Troiani to recreate this moment, 15-year-old James Fortin standing near the facade of Independence Hall, watching the Rhode Island Regiment march down Chestnut Street. So a pretty moving painting that's part of the museum's collection now. And we were able to commission it with funding from the Washington Rochambeau Revolutionary Route National Historic Trail Park Service.
Great. That's great. We were talking with Matthew Skake. It's great that you have all of these events that happen really right around where the museum is on the streets.
Right. That the army marched right past where the museum is today. You know, we're right in the heart of historic Philadelphia, two blocks away from Independence Hall, a block away from Carpenter's Hall. So when visitors come to Philadelphia and they want this rich and dynamic experience in encountering the American Revolution here in the city, you can come to the Museum of the American Revolution that sort of ties these historic sites together in a way to tell this the story of the revolution.
Yes, it does. And Fortin, you said that Fortin, you from the beginning of the museum, you've made him kind of one of the focal points because he does have this story that captivates particularly young people from Philadelphia coming into the museum.
Exactly right. Yeah, it's a local story. You know, he's a Philadelphian, which is great. He grew up in the neighborhood, basically. And then in one of the most popular parts of our core exhibit at the museum is the bow or the front half of a privateer vessel that you can go aboard. And it's a great spot for our school tours and other student groups that come. And oftentimes our educators are sharing the story of James Fortin aboard that ship because they're talking to, you know, fourth and fifth graders or middle schoolers or high schoolers, some of whom are very close in age to what Fortin was when he was on that ship.
Because he's 15 when he's aboard this ship.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. He joins at 14 and serves into his 15th year. Mm-hmm. And And so he is, you know, approximately their age. And, you know, we encourage the students to kind of put themselves in his shoes and imagine being in that situation. It's tough to imagine. And but we can build historical empathy in that way by sharing a story like Fortin's, and also to share that these were real people making real decisions. It just happened nearly 250 years ago. These were decisions that weren't just impacting their own lives, but impacting others, like Fortin's effort to let Daniel Bruton go in that sea chest instead of himself. It's a selfless act, an act of courage and bravery. So these are, you know, longstanding and, you know, still relevant decisions to helping students understand their own decision-making in their daily lives.
Right. These are these choices that people are making. We're talking with Matthew Stick, the curator of exhibitions at the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia. And let's talk about, you have just opened a new exhibit on Washington's tent, and that's been kind of the centerpiece of the museum since the beginning. And what other exhibits do we have in the offing for the museum?
Yeah, so Witness to Revolution, The Unlikely Travels of Washington's Tent, just opened in February of 2024. And that's an exhibit that tells the story of how George Washington's headquarters tent got from the Revolutionary War to the Museum of the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. So our award-winning tent theater experience is just the tip of the iceberg of that really compelling story. It's a dramatic way of sharing it, but a lot was left on the cutting room floor to share how that tent survived over the past nearly 250 years. So this exhibit is bringing that story to the forefront. The tent, of course, is still on display here at the museum. And next year—
You also have a replica tent.
Exactly. Yep. We just had that replica tent down at Mount Vernon for their Revolutionary War weekend. But this is it's a hand-sewn replica of George Washington's sleeping and office marquee, the original of which we have in our collection, and his dining marquee, which is in the Smithsonian Institution's collection. And so this is a traveling outreach program where visitors get to engage in some experiential learning and go inside Washington's tentage and kind of imagine what it might have been like for General Washington in some of the complex decision-making that he's doing on his level as Commander-in-Chief
of
the Continental Army. And so
what else is in the offing, Matthew?
Yeah, coming up in 2025 after Witness to Revolution closes, in connection with the 250th anniversary of the beginning of the Revolutionary War, of course, the Battle of Lexington Concord, we're opening an exhibit on April 19th, 2025, called Banners of Liberty, which is bringing together about a dozen original flags from the Revolutionary War. In many cases, the first time that these flags have been together in one room where you get to see them all there. So that'll be open April 19th through the summer of 2025. And then in the fall of 2025, we open up our major exhibit on the Declaration of Independence called The Declaration's Journey. And this is the museum's, the heart and soul of the museum's 250th 2026 project. And this is an exhibit that's exploring the global history of the Declaration of Independence and really considering the Declaration of Independence as Philadelphia's greatest export, how other nations around the world have not only sought inspiration from the Declaration of Independence, but also encouraged the United States to expand its promise of equality and its efforts for independence here in the United States, and then also how other nations have declared their independence over the past 250 years as a result of this new kind of genre of document, a Declaration of Independence. So we'll be exploring ideas and stories that are connected to the Haitian Revolution, the women's rights movement, and the Seneca Falls Convention. We'll be discussing Gandhi's efforts for independence for India, and also South American independence movements of the 19th century.
Right.
As well as one of the most famous references to the Declaration of Independence, and that's Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech.
So
we'll be bringing together documents and artifacts to tell this kind of global story of the Declaration of Independence.
It's amazing. Now, would you have imagined when you were back in school thinking, I'd like to be a museum curator one day, that you'd be working with Washington's tent, the Declaration of Independence, the story of James Fortin? I mean, you have these tremendous touchstones of history that you're able to present to the rest of us.
I maybe dreamed about it, but never thought it could be reality. But here we are. It's I have to pinch myself every day when I get to do this kind of work. It's really a dream come true, and I get to work with great colleagues here at the museum, and who share that similar passion for this time period and encouraging more and more Americans and international visitors to realize that the American Revolution is not just 8 years from 1775 to 1783. That's the Revolutionary War. The Revolutionary War is one aspect of the American Revolution, one part of it, a dramatic part of it, the beginning of it, really. But the American Revolution is ongoing. It's really kind of encouraging and fostering the ideas of liberty, equality, liberty and equality for more and more people every day.
That's great. Yeah, we've been talking with Matthew Skick, the curator of exhibitions at the Museum of the American Revolution. And your exhibits, like the James Fortin exhibit, you have an online component where we can continue watching them if we don't have a chance to come to the museum. Although, of course, people are encouraged to get to the museum to see the Witness to Revolution and the Declaration's Journey and these other exhibits that you have in the offing, as well as your permanent exhibits. Anything else? I feel like we could be here all day, Matthew, talking about what's going on in your museum and in the revolution that you cover. Anything else we should mention before we let you go?
Well, just as a note about that, those 360-degree virtual tours of those exhibits, they're really great ways to encounter it. If you encounter the stories that we share with just a click of your mouse, you can explore it as if you're in the room. But if you're able to make it to Philadelphia, I do encourage you to come.
Yeah. The James Fortin exhibit also has music because his daughter wrote something that becomes an abolitionist hymn, an abolitionist anthem.
Exactly. Yeah, that is what's called The Grave of the Slave. It's a poem written by Sarah Fortin, one of James Fortin's daughters, who is extremely talented poet. She was a member with her mother and sisters of the Philadelphia Female Anti-Slavery Society, alongside Lucretia Mott, for example. One of the Fortin family's friends was the very famous in his day and talented band leader, African-American band leader, Francis Johnson, who actually set Sarah Fortin's poem to music. And it became sort of an abolitionist anthem in a way. It was talking about how an enslaved person, it's actually quite a solemn tune, but it's talking about how an enslaved person can only find freedom in death when they die, unless they're freed in another way. But so many enslaved people, millions of enslaved people by the mid 19th century are really not able to live their lives in the way that they want to be. And the only way they can find freedom is in death. It's a very solemn poem, but it's pointing to the fact that the horrors of slavery that, although James Fortin was never enslaved, his children were never enslaved, they never took that for granted. They instead are channeling their wealth, their talents, their efforts to try and end slavery in the United States.
That's a great story. So thank you very much, Matthew, for joining us. And I encourage folks to check out your website and visit the museum if you can. Matthew Skick is the curator of exhibitions at the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia. And so thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Bob. Appreciate it.
Also thank Jonathan Lane, our producer, the man behind the curtain, as well as our listeners around the country, around the world. And every week I thank folks who are tuning in regularly. And if you are in one of these places, send Jonathan Lane an email, jlane@revolution250.org, and I'll send you some of our Rev 250 swag. We have playing cards, we have refrigerator magnets, we have scarves. I never know what else Jonathan is going to come up with to have for the revolutionary symbols circulating among folks. So Jonathan Lane, thank you. And this week, friends in Philadelphia and in Denver, Long Beach, and Sebastopol, California, Colchester and Vernon in the state of Connecticut, Escanaba and Detroit in Michigan, Short Hills, New Jersey, Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, and Wynendskill, New York, and here in Massachusetts, the town of Arlington, formerly Menotomee. So thank you all for listening in those places and places between and beyond. And now we will be piped out on the road to Boston.